Six Music.
BBC Radio, Six Music Documentaries.
Welcome, I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time on Six Music, where we speak to some of music's most influential figures about the pivotal first moments that shaped their lives and careers, the events and songs that led them to be where and who they are today. In many ways, Paul Heaton defies musical categorisation. A lyrical romantic, yet also an arch satirist. A singer whose voice is part Northern crooner and part Memphis soul. He fronted the House Martins, a band who mixed Marxist politics and Christianity, yet they were also one of the only early 80s indie bands to cross over into the mainstream. After that, he formed the Beautiful South, an unpretentious, modest, yet sophisticated pop group working in an era defined by grunge, who quickly became one of the biggest and best-loved bands in the country. In 1994, one in seven UK households owned a Beautiful South record. Here he talks about his early and incredibly diverse musical influences, the birth of the House Martins and their resultant split. He also talks about how he dealt with the massive success of the Beautiful South, his battles with alcohol and a lifetime dominated by an almost obsessional love of music. And I started by asking Paul, as is traditional here on the first time, when he first became aware of music.
I think my first musical memory, I've got a couple. There was a kid who lived across the road from us called Alan Bardsley, and in his, like, he had like a loft, you know, like a loft conversion or something like that, and he had a little pool table about a couple of feet long, and people would go up to Alan Bardsley's loft and play pool or whatever it was, snooker or something. It was a pretty bad sloping table, but he had a record player and he had those Top of the Pops records. And
which were like cover versions.
Yeah, awful cover versions. The only comparable thing, really, is the sort of supermarket music. You know, when you hear, you think, oh, that's a nice song, and then you realise it's a ghastly version of the same song. So it was pretty awful music. But and then I'd heard one of the songs I heard on the record was Johnny Cash's Thing Called Love, but it wasn't Johnny Cash. When I heard Johnny Cash singing it, it sounded like an oral explosion, if you see what I mean. It was just unbelievable. That was one of my first memories. The other memory, really, really ingrained into me, was there was a school disco at St. Columbus Youth Club in Sheffield on Manchester Road. And not a school disco, like a church disco sort of thing, you know.
Youth club kind of thing.
Youth club type of thing. And my brother and his mates were allowed to go, and I was under 12 at the time, and I wasn't allowed in. And I remember me and my middle brother sneaking to the edge of the door and looking underneath the door, and they were playing Gene Genie by David Bowie. And at the time, the platform they were called stack heels, were in fashion. So it was wooden stacked heels. My brother, Mark, and his mates were all doing this dance, banging their stack heels on the floor. And it was unbelievable. I was just like, wow. That, you know, it's really, really loud. The louder them, the noise of them banging their stack heels was louder than the music itself.
City, strung out on lasers and slashback blazers, and ate all your razors while pulling the waders, talking about Monroe and walking on Snow White. New York's a go-go and everything tastes nice. Poor little greenie. Get back on. Gene Genie lives on his back. Like a reptile, she loves him, but just for a short while. She'll scratch in the sand, let go his hand. He says he's a beautician, sells you nutrition, keeps all your dead hair for making up underwear. Poor little greenie.
That was Gene Genie by David Bowie from 1972, one of glam rock's greatest achievements and a song that had a forceful impact on the young Paul Heaton, my guest here on The First Time. So another important first has to be your first single. I asked Paul what his was.
A thing called Love by Johnny Cash. And you know when you get money for your birthday, whatever it was, I came into a lot of money when I was about 10 or 11.
Got like £10 in Boots vouchers.
It seemed a lot of money. Well, actually, it was Green Shield stamps in those days, but it seemed a lot of money, and I went out and bought two singles at once. Because I think people lie. I don't think people got exactly 25p for their first birthday. I think they got 50p and bought two singles. So I bought two, Jackson 5, Hallelujah Day, and Johnny Cash sing Call Love.
Six, he stood on the ground. He weighed 235 pounds. But I saw that giant of a man brought down to his knees by love. He was the kind of a man that would gamble on luck, look you in the eye and never back up. But I saw him crying like a little whipped pup because of love. You can't see it with your eyes, hold it in your hand. But like the wind that covers our land, strong enough to rule the heart of any man, this thing called love. It can lift you up, never let you down, take your world and turn it all around. Ever since time, nothing's ever been found that's stronger than love. Like me, they struggle in doubts. They trouble their minds day in and day out. Too busy with living to worry about a little word like love. But when I see a mother's tenderness as she holds her young close to her breast, then I thank God that the world's been blessed with a thing called love. You can't see it with your eyes, hold it in your hand. But like the wind that covers our land, strong enough to rule the heart of any man, this thing called love. It can lift you up, never let you down, take your world and turn it all around. Ever since time, nothing's ever been found that's stronger than love. Ever since time, nothing's ever been found that's stronger than love.
When did you first decide to try performing or singing yourself?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you were asked at school, weren't you, to sing along? And I remember I've got a school report from probably about the age of 11 where it says Paul has an excellent singing voice. And I remember I was asked to join the choir at the local church, but my mum, you know, didn't want me to, you know, go anywhere religious. I remember, yeah, you had little. There was a kid called Ian France, and to this day I was very jealous of him. He got all the singing parts, you know, all the parts where you had to sing by yourself. Ian France got them, and I always wanted to sing. I wanted to sing. I was shy, believe it or not, and I used to go bright red when I sung, but I didn't have any real desire to make music. Do you know what I mean? That came much later.
What about your first album, your first kind of proper, fully formed musical obsession, I suppose?
After my first few singles, which were sort of an odd, you know, like you'd hear a song on the radio and you'd buy those, I then began collecting punk singles, but I never really bought any punk albums. So my first album I bought was called This Is Soul, where I think it had Wilson Pickett or Eddie Floyd on the front cover. And it had a series of the usual sort of soul artists, you know, Aretha Franklin, Otis Redding, Sam and Dave, etc. And it was a great record, and that started my collection, really. This Is Soul. I actually think I got it from an Oxfam shop for 50p, and I still have it.
Al Green is someone that you've mentioned in previous interviews as being a big influence. Was he one of the soul artists that really
Love
early on?
Yeah, he was the one artist. I mean, I can't get anywhere near him anymore, but he's the one artist I could sing along to. I couldn't sing along to Otis or Aretha, and they had totally different voices. But Al Green was high-pitched like I was, and I found it quite easy singing along to him. And also, he was somebody I could try and impersonate, which sort of developed my voice. I think it's only by trying to be somebody you're not that you develop who you are, if you see what I mean. And I was trying to be Al Green, and obviously I didn't sound like Al Green, and never have done, but that's who I wanted to sound like. And so I'd practice, I'd say 2 or 3 hours a day I would be singing.
Really?
Yeah, just constant singing. I was thinking, how can you mend a broken heart and Let's Stay Together? Just going on and on and on and on. And obviously by the time the House Martins were formed, a couple of years later, I had quite a well-rehearsed and well-stretched voice, and I could sing a pretty high falsetto, and unlike now. Now, I can still sing a bit, of course.
What's the Al Green track we should play?
I think we should play How Can You Mend a Broken Heart. It's everything it's everything good about him. All the little bits he leaves out, as Homer would say.
I can think of younger days when I lived for my life. Was everything a man could want to do. Could never see tomorrow. I was never told about the sorrow. And how can you mend a broken heart? Can you stop the rain from falling down? Tell me, how can you stop the sun from shining? What makes the world go round? This broken man, yeah. How can a loser ever win? Somebody please help me. Still feel the breeze that rustles through the trees, and misty memories of days gone by. But we could never see tomorrow. Would you believe that no one ever told us about the sorrow? So how can we mend a broken heart? And mine is, how can you stop the rain from falling down? Stop us, that old sun from shining. What makes the world go round? And sometime I have to say, la 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 la
I just wanna live again, baby. How can you mend this broken man? Yeah. Somebody tell me, how can a loser ever win? I'm gonna say,
you mentioned the House Martins. Can you remember what the band's first gigs were like? Were they quite fully formed?
Yeah, the first gigs... Well, first of all, we started as a two-piece, and I was sort of getting quite serious about my lyric writing, starting to write probably better lyrics than, you know, the infantile stuff I'd been writing. And I was wanting to be... all I remember is everybody smiling and sort of laughing. And it was only when I saw pictures I realised Stan... The way Stan moved about on stage was quite... funny, really, and quite jokey. So we used to go down well. We were good entertainers, me and Stan, and we took that on into the House Martins, you know, the sort of the full piece band. So when we were a full piece, we used to get, yeah, great reactions, really, because we'd sing a cappella, which was unusual. We'd sing, you know, a couple of soul songs, and the rest of the songs would sound quite sort of raw and indie sounding.
So what's your relationship like with Happy Hour now, which was your kind of first hit? Because sometimes people kind of have, musicians have a difficult relationship with maybe the first song that they were initially known for. Do you see it as a bit of a millstone?
Well, I think there's a reason people have problems with their first song is because everybody associates you with that song, you know, but, and the same with Song Forever with Beautiful South, everybody sort of like, so it's like a tattoo that you wear for the rest of your life, but I was fortunate... That one, it's not a one-hit wonder, you know. And secondly, I think Happy Hour sounds great. You know, like when I listen to it, if it comes on, well, obviously I play it around the house all the time, doing my dance. But when I'm not playing it around the house and I hear it on the radio, it just sounds like a great record. Really, you know, I'm not bothered being big-headed or what. It just sounds like a well-produced record. Sounds as though we're having fun, which we were, you know. And same with the video, really.
What a good place to be. Don't believe it. All the minds and they love to buy you all a drink. And if we ask all the questions, then you take all your clothes up and back to the kitchen sink. What a good place to be. Don't believe it. A good place to be. Don't believe it. Speak a different language and it's never really happened to me. Don't believe it. Oh no. Cause it's never been happened to me. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. It's happy again. Again.
Your first album, London Ill Health 4, did really, really well, incredibly well. I mean, at a time when the charts were dominated by Dire Straits and
yeah.
Wham and Simply Red, it seemed to be kind of you and the Smiths were the only people doing something
yeah.
at a high level that wasn't this high sheen, highly polished, almost hyper-real, unreal kind of music.
Yeah.
Did it feel like you were doing something special and different?
Well, not in a way, because we were from a long-standing sort of John Peel sort of audience. So every time a Peel band got in, it was like a bit of a snub nose to the rest of the charts. And Because we came from that tradition, we just felt like another one of his bands that had sort of conquered the charts. So we didn't feel especially special. But looking back on it, you know, when you look at who was on Top of the Pops and the hair, you know, the unbelievable hair, we're quite an oddity, as the Smiths were as well, you know. And also the other thing that marked a John Peel band out, really, you know, certainly with the Smiths and ourselves, is the lack of keyboards, because keyboards on 80s songs really date them. And yeah, it's racks of keyboards and just the sound. When they were trying to be really modern, they didn't realise that that was going to sound like 1985 or 86. And it does. Whilst with a song like How Soon Is Now or Happy Hour or whatever, you can't really place it because it hasn't got those sounds on it. So that makes it easier to like, if so. I mean, it makes it an easier part of your past.
Your first number one was Caravan of Love.
Yeah.
Jasper Isley track. Why choose that song? Because it's, from the outside, seemed to be an unusual track to cover.
Yeah, it was. It was. It had only happened the year before. Because when we sang it live, I remember Paul Weller, my trusty steed, Paul Weller, slagging it off, saying, why have they destroyed that old Isley's track? And it had actually been from the year before. And it sounded... When I remember me and Norman were into our sort of current soul, and I still am now, I still listen to new soul, and which is quite unusual. And when me and Norman heard Caravan of Love, we thought that sounds like a classic, you know, and we should do it. And there was a lot of songs out at the time. The Gap Band were making some great songs at the time, and the Isley Brothers and Isley Jasper Isley were still making great records. So it just seemed a natural, it had a real old school sort of mid-70s peace theme about it as well. You're quite hippie-ish, which we liked. So yeah, it seemed an obvious choice, but it was, yeah, as you say, an unusual.
That was Isley Jesper Isley with their 1985 smooth soul school disco slow dancing classic Caravan of Love, a track that would be famously covered by the House Martins in 1986, giving them their first and only number one single.
Six. The children of the world can see this is a better place for us to be. The place in which we were born, so neglected and torn apart. Every woman, every man,
Join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up,
stand up.
Everybody take a stand. Join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up,
stand up.
I'm your brother. I'm your brother, don't you know? She's my sister. She's my sister, don't you know? We'll be living in a world of peace. In the day when everyone is free. We'll bring the young and the old. Won't you let your love flow?
From your heart. Every woman, every man, join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up,
stand up.
Everybody take a stand. Join the caravan of love.
Stand up,
stand up,
stand up.
I'm your brother. I'm your brother, don't you know? She's my sister.
Welcome back, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time, here on Six Music, with my guest, House Martins and beautiful South frontman, and now solo star, Paul Heaton. And that was the House Martins' Caravan of Love from December 1986, the band's first and only number one.
When did you first decide to form a new band? Was it quite an immediate overlap, or did you have to take a bit of time to get one girlfriend out of your system before starting going out with another one, so to speak?
I had an affair behind the House Martins' back. I was seeing another woman. I felt as though it was a break, but looking back on it, it was probably only a couple of months, really. I lived down the same street as Dave Rotheray. He was at 96, I was at 52. See, I can give these addresses out now without fear of reprisal. And Dave had always been, he was one of the few people, local musicians, who through gritted teeth had congratulated me and said the House Martins were great. And he was just nice, really. There was a lot of jealousy. Hull can be quite a jealous place. Most people, like my football mates, were absolutely delighted. But there's some musicians, it wasn't their sort of thing. But anyway, so I had Dave in mind. I liked Dave Hemingway's singing, so I had him as a singer. And again, I got it into my head that I wanted to be Womack and Womack. Again, a current soul band, really, and they'd had the Teardrops song on that album.
Brilliant
track. Yeah, great track. And if you listen to Keep It All In with a generous ear, you can almost see that I'm trying to emulate that sort of call and response thing that record had, and I just wanted to work with female singers. So when I chucked the House Martins, I had in mind straight away that I'd wanted a female singer, you know, because I'd begun writing tracks for a female singer. I didn't think the House Martins audience would take to having us. It was a pretty laddish crowd. I don't mean laddish as in behaving laddishly. It was a mainly lads, mainly blokes crowd. And I thought I'd best start again and afresh.
What else were you listening to at the time when you started forming the beautiful South? What were your
I was listening to
there?
Well, New Soul, believe it or not. On the first album, there's a Girlfriend Pebbles cover, which had been from probably 87 or 88. I was listening to a lot of country music, Randy Travis and Nancy Griffith in particular. So I'd started writing sort of country lyrics, so things like A Little Time were in my head, and you know. So yeah, a variety of music as usual, still listening to, you know, the sort of John Peel end of things as well, but mainly the new music I was listening to was country and soul.
Let's talk about country. Willie Nelson is someone that, yeah, you've mentioned in interviews, and the new stuff, which we'll come to in a bit, has definitely got a country flavour to it. When did you first start absorbing that?
Well, I remember Andy Kershaw doing a show. He used to do these travelogues, very good travelogues, where he went and interviewed Randy Travis and Nancy Graham, some of the new country artists. That was quite a big influence on me. There wasn't many people, maybe just Bob Harris was playing new country stuff. And Willie Nelson was somebody whose voice I just always loved. Willie Nelson, again, he's got a voice that a long, long way away from mine, you know, a bit like Al Green and Otis Redding, and miles, miles from anything I could do. And you tend to like those voices. So I'd listened to Willie Nelson before, but then I started listening to the new country of Randy Travis and Clint Black and people like that.
What's the Willie Nelson track we should play?
I should play Valentine.
Cause that's a beautiful,
yeah, it's a beautiful song, yeah.
Valentine, won't you be my Valentine? And introduce your heart to mine. And be my Valentine. Summertime, we could run and play like summertime. With storybooks and nursery rhymes. So be my Valentine. Candy heart, if anyone could, you could have a candy heart. You're the sweetest of all sweethearts. Won't you give your heart to me? Can't you see? I love you, Valentine. Won't you be my Valentine? And won't you share your space with mine? And be my Valentine.
Nelson with the gorgeous Valentine, the choice of my guest here on the first time, Mr. Paul Heaton.
When Carry On Up the Charts, the Beautiful South's greatest hits, was released in 1994, it became something of a phenomenon, going five times platinum. I asked Paul how it felt when he first realised his group had become a household name.
I think Dave Rothery's explanation of it was probably the closest you'd get. He saw it as previously we'd only been in a first past the post race, and suddenly second voters started to count. And so although we weren't people's favourite band, when they heard all the songs together, we were everybody's second favourite band. And so we became enormous on the AV system, which is sort of, it's a modest way of putting it, and maybe a bit too modest. I'd actually argued against putting it out as well.
Really?
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm man enough to admit that.
Why?
Because I don't know. I just thought it was a bit of a cop-out. But obviously, when I was taking my bags of cash to the bank every Monday morning...
There has always been a strong political voice in your songwriting. Basically, romance and politics seem to be the sort of dominant themes.
Yeah.
But when did you first kind of become politically aware and decide to put that part of your character in your work?
Between 1984-85, the miners' strike was what really politicised me. Mm. I think previous to that, I'd felt politics was a bit studenty. Do you know what I mean? And I hadn't been a student, and I thought being left wing was being like a student. You know, like, oh yeah, they're just from rich backgrounds or whatever. But during the miners' strike, being in Hull and going over to Doncaster and the surrounding mining area, it really politicised me, the fact that ordinary people were politically educated, which the miners were incredibly politically educated, and seeing them link their struggles straight away to the struggles in South Africa and throughout the world, it sort of put the last jigsaw piece there, and and everything fitted in then, everything how I'd felt, you know, settled down and started putting it into writing. Probably the House Martins' first record, Flag Day, and Stand at Ease, the B-side, probably writing those, which I think would have been written in late 84, would have been my first stabs at political writing.
Was it bands like The Clash who had a very much clear voice in that world that kind of helped inspire you?
Well, at the time, you see, I went on most of The Clash's Give Them Enough Rope tour. You know, not most of it, but a lot of it. Went to a lot of gigs, me and my brother. And I don't know, at the time I wasn't sure about Joe Strummer's politics. I wasn't one of these people who thought, yeah, what he says is right. I wanted an independent view, but I think it helped me. So helped me think that singing and singing in a band and being political was okay. Do you know what I mean? It felt right to watch it. I just didn't necessarily agree with what he said.
What's the Clash song we should play?
Probably one from Give Them Enough Rope. I think it was a bit of an underrated album.
I was going to say, it's not the record that people often choose when they want to...
It's better than Sandinista, and it's better than London... I think it's better than London Calling. I'm not sure if it's good as the first one, but I would play Tommy Gunn.
South, there'd always seem to be, from the outside anyway, tensions kind of running through the band, or it seemed that way because people left with such alarming regularity. Are you an easy person to be in a band with?
Well, first of all, I have to pick you up on your first comment about tension. There wasn't really much tension. I don't think I'm an easy person to be in a band with, no. I pay well, you know, I've always been fair, but it's a benevolent dictatorship, without a doubt. Really, if you look at over 19 years, we only changed twice. That's not too bad. But the fact that the record of them both being women is poor. The woman's role in the beautiful South was, how can I put this, entirely unsupported. if you see what I mean. You were a woman alone, you had to stand for yourself. And that's not to say they either of them left through weaknesses. They didn't. But I think they felt as though they couldn't forever be, I suppose, isolated. Not deliberately isolated. You know, they were, you know, we weren't laddish. There was no, you know, we never watched stupid films on the bus or behaved, you know, like the, there was none of the normal laddish behaviour. But it just wears you down, you know, just being away with 10 blokes, you know, 10 young blokes, immature blokes, you know. So, yeah, I regret that. I regret that Brenner and Jackie weren't more supported.
You've talked about your battle with alcohol around the time. Did that, was that one of the factors that caused you to leave the band?
No, you mean the Beautiful South? No, not at all. There was a lot of people battling alcohol in the band. I was the most public about my problem, just because I'm quite open about things like that. You know, I don't feel the harm in talking about it. It certainly didn't drive the band apart. Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. Alcohol, very interesting. Right the way back to this diary that I have in front of me, which I still, if you look at all the gigs, it says how much I've drunk.
Really? That's interesting.
It says how much I've been paid. That's very Yorkshire. How much I've drunk and what the score was in the gig, you know, whether we won or lost.
Was it difficult to leave the Beautiful South? I mean, you know, it's 19 years. It's a massively successful group.
Well, it was a very lazy decision to keep in the Beautiful South because I was working with people I enjoyed working with, you know, people I knew. And I couldn't be bothered to, you know, I suppose, again, back to the marriage or the girlfriend relationship, you know, you find yourself in a situation sometimes, or you might have done in the past. You're just going out with that person because you can't be bothered to go through the whole rigmarole of meeting somebody and shaving your face and putting deodorant on under your armpits.
Trimming your nose hair.
Yeah, that sort of stuff. Yeah. So it was very much like that. I was happy growing my nose hair in the Beautiful South. I should have left earlier. That's not to say anything against the people in the band. You know, we had a great friendship. But yeah, it was just a bit of laziness. And when I did, I felt quite liberated. And especially since my albums haven't sold so well, weirdly enough.
I was going to ask you, yeah, because the first kind of solo album that you did,
yeah,
which was 2001 as Biscuit.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I suppose that's the first record. But after this enormous success with two massively successful and very, very loved bands, the profile dropped quite significantly, which was quite a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing I can do about that, really. I made the record and, you know, I sing the songs and I suppose radio or whatever or television, I don't want to blame anybody, but didn't pick up on it. And I think it's mainly because, like Lucas said, I had to rebrand myself. It was a drink that you had when you were pretending that you were ill to your mum and dad. And now it's a sports drink and I had to do that with Paul Heaton.
So we've had all these firsts, now we come on to the last song, which I'd like you to choose. It can be anything you want.
Well, I think it would have to be The Buzzcocks and I Don't Mind. And it was the first song where I remember hearing it on John Peel. I remember getting it home to my record player. My record player had 5 2p bits stacked on top so the needle wouldn't jump because the needle was that old. And I put it on and I bounced up and down on my bed, which is probably where my needle issues came from. Bounced up and down on my bed and was just, I just thought, I really want to be in a band after this. And it was just brilliant. And then I just sort of got on with it after that. So it's I Don't Mind, The Buzzcocks.
It's been lovely to speak to you. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you.
Reality's a dream, a game in which I seem to never find out just what I am. I don't know if I'm an actor or a shaman or sham. But if you don't mind, so how can I undo the tangle of these words? I keep leaving, I don't know if I should be believing this empty perceiving. But if you don't mind, I don't mind. I used to bet that you didn't care, but kinda never got me anywhere. This time I used to be so sure, something about you made me doubt you more. Could you convince me? When everything I see just makes me feel you're putting me down. And if it's true, this pathetic clown will keep hanging around. Let's if you don't mind, I don't mind.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
Good vibration, yeah. That's the positive vibes in.